Today is April 2nd, 1984. My name is Tika Ward. I'm interviewing Sue Kendrick. We are at 104 Woodmore Avenue, Louisville, Kentucky. Our topic is Lou Tate and the Little Moon House. As we begin, Sue, I want you to tell me a little bit about your background.
Well, do you want me to start with the fact that I was one of 10 children and lived on a farm in Franklin County, that I was the next to the oldest, and I wanted a little sister, and I really wanted a sister, but the next one was a boy, and the next one was a boy, and the next one was a boy, so finally, one December the 21st, I had a little sister born. A father saw how pleased I was over having a girl, and he went to the closet, got a little red rocking chair out of the closet, set it down in front of the fireplace in Grandmother's room, and he said, "I don't think Santa Claus will mind that gave you the chair a little bit early, because he brought it quite a while ago." Then he went after my little sister, stuck her in my lap, and said, "Here. Here's the girl," and she's been mine ever since. My maiden name was Susan Lee Cardwell, but my husband didn't care much for the name Susie, which my parents called me Susie for my grandmother and Lee for my grandfather Cardwell. So Susie Lee was what my parents and the family all called me, but my husband said, "No, I don't like the name Susie," so he called me Sue. And all the friends that I made in life after I married called me Sue.
When did you meet your husband?
I met him at Berea when we were both in school there. I actually met him in 1924 when I was a senior in the normal school. And he was in academy. His roommate was a normal school student, and so he often came over to our dining room to eat, which you weren't supposed to do. But he did. He came over to our dining room to eat.
When did you all marry?
1933, June, in the president's house at Berea, married by the president of Berea College, who was the Presbyterian minister.
Tell me when you first met Lou Tate and how long you've known her.
Well, I met Lou Tate at Berea also, but after I went back to college, and I had been out and teaching and went back to college, so I met her in 1926, when she graduated in 27, and I didn't graduate until 29. We had literary societies at Berea instead of sororities. And so she and I both belonged to Pi Epsilon Pi. And that's how come I knew who she was. And she was what you might call a big wheel in the society, because she was very talented. And she didn't mind letting people know that she knew how to do certain things. So they were always calling on her, "What do you think, Lou Tate? Will you do so-and-so, Lou Tate?" Now, she came by the name Lou Tate instead of Louisa Tate Bousman, because after she left Berea, she was, we called her Louisa in those days, and some people called her Tate, but her family called her Tate. We called her Louisa or Tate, depending on whether you thought of Tate or Louisa when you were talking to her. But she came by her name through Mrs. Hoover, the wife of President Hoover. She was Tate taught with one of my classmates in one of the mountain schools of Mrs. Hoover in West Virginia. And Mrs. Hoover often had Tate and Christine Vest and Tate were teaching in the same school. And Mrs. Hoover often had them at the White House. They, not only for conferences, but for fun, because she liked both girls very much. And one day, one time she was introducing Lou Tate to the crowd, and she said, Louisa Tate Boseman. I can't say that. From now on, you're just going to be plain Lou Tate. And so from now then on, she was Lou Tate.
Do you remember the very first time you saw her or became aware of her?
Yes. She was dancing with all sorts of veils on her, doing some sort of aerobic dancing for Pi Epsilon Pi meeting that we had. She sailed across the stage with those drapes floating out behind her, and so she danced on her toes and got rooted around. And I thought, oh my gosh, what is this? Because I had never seen anything like that before, being a little country girl off of a farm.
You said that you started Berea in 1922.
Yes, and finished the teacher training in 24. In those days, if you were a high school graduate, 2 years of teacher training were all that you needed in order to teach in the grade schools in Kentucky. You didn't have to have your degree. But I went back to get my degree so that I could teach in either high school or grade school as I wished.
Tell me what the other students thought of Lou Tate.
Well, I don't rightly know, but she had a way about her that everybody looked up to her. She was brilliant. And so everyone sort of kowtowed to her in a way, and you always wanted Lou Tate present because you wanted her input on anything that you were planning or doing. She just was that type of person that you always wanted to have her around.
What did she do after graduation?
She went to Michigan to get her master's degree in history.
You remembered that Mrs. Hoover, you had said that Mrs. Hoover was looking for young people to help run her settlement
mm-hmm.
school.
Mm-hmm. And so she spent a year or more. I honestly do not remember how long she was with Mrs. Hoover in the school.
But she was one of the students who was recommended.
Yes, she and Christine Best were the two that Berea recommended as the helpers for Mrs. Hoover. Lou Tate was the type of person that never sat still or stood still. She went out into the community to meet the families of her students, and they talked weaving with the grandmothers that she met. And they gave her many of the weaving patterns that she has tucked away at the loom house. They knew that she was truly interested, and so they gave her those little rolls of paper.
One of which you have given me.
Mm-hmm.
Sue, did she weave in those days?
No, not that I know of. She didn't weave, as far as I know, until she came back to Louisville. And then she bought the big looms and wove in her parents' home. She wove as a student. All of us had to do 2 hours of labor a day. That was a Berea requirement. Nobody got by under 2 hours. And some of them were working for half a day in order to pay their tuition. Berea was run largely by student labor, because of students who could not afford to pay their tuition at any other school, and nor even at Berea, which had very low tuition. That was why I went, with my parents with 10 children, couldn't afford to send me to an expensive college.
What was Berea like in those days?
Oh, it was wonderful. You were not allowed to wear patent leather shoes. You were not allowed to wear silk hose. You were not allowed to dress so that even though you had a Sunday go to meeting dress that was a little better than your everyday dresses, you were not allowed to wear it at all times. That was for parties.
So I suppose what Lou Tate was doing, dancing and dressing like that, that was different, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. No. The other students were, most of them in the same boat I was. They'd never seen or heard of anything like that before. Because, see, that was before the days of television. It was even before the days of radio to amount to much. I can remember listening to the radio with a crystal set with a little plug in your ear so you could hear what was going on the radio.
You graduated from Berea, and eventually you moved to Louisville.
Yes, I graduated in 29. And I went back to Berea to teach, and I married in 33, and it was after Sam and I spent 1 year at Pine Mountain Settlement School, and then we came to Louisville. And when we came to Louisville, that was when we got acquainted with Lou Tate all over again.
When you moved to Louisville, where did you move first?
Oh, in two rooms over top of a garage on Park Boulevard.
Was it anywhere near the Loon House or Third Street?
No.
So how did you and Lou Tate get in touch with one another?
Well, through the Berea paper. Each of us took the alumnus. And so she knew that I was in Louisville, and I knew she was, and I do not remember which one of us called the other to find out if we could get together.
Do you recall the first time you all did get together, or?
Yes, we were playing Rook with one of the young men who worked for the Courier Journal. They made a foursome. She and he and my husband.
Where did you all play?
We played at my apartment over the garage on Park Boulevard.
At that point, so this was 1935.
Five. Mm-hmm.
At that point, she was still on Third Street.
Mm-hmm.
They had not yet bought the cabin.
No.
Tell us about the Third Street house.
Oh, the Third Street house was a big old rambling house with a little round silo, my husband called it, at the front. And it was beautiful inside and outside because he was interested in wood, and it had so much woodwork to it. The stairway, the winding stairway was wood, and paneling here, there, and yonder was wood. And even the silo had wood in it. And so he was very interested in it.
By that time, what had Lou Tate done in the meantime?
Oh, she had gone into commercial weaving, and she was weaving bedspreads and curtains and things of that sort and selling and yard goods.
And you said she had a big loom.
She had several of them. She had at least two.
Were they on the first floor, the second floor?
As I recall, one was on the first floor and one in her bedroom on the second floor.
She had also gone on to graduate school in the meantime.
Yes, and had gotten her master's. But she was interested mostly in had gotten so interested in weaving that weaving had taken over as her main thought.
Would she talk to you about it?
Yes.
Would she talk to you about?
Yeah. Oh, we talked about people that we had known at Berea. And about weaving. And her father loved to play bridge. And my husband loved to play bridge. I never learned to play bridge to amount to anything because I was too interested in other things. I wouldn't care too much about trying to figure out in my head who had what card. So I didn't really play bridge. But Lou Tate and her father both played bridge. And then Mary and Virginia Walters, who were friends of Lou Tate's, also liked to play bridge. And so the three families of us would get together real often to play bridge.
Would you sometimes play at the Third Street house?
Oh, yes. We played at the Third Street house, and when we did, we usually ate our evening meal there. We played often at my house, and I cooked the evening meal. And we went to the Waters apartment sometimes, and Mary or Virginia or both of them would prepare me.
What was her family like, Lou Tate?
Well, she had a grandmother and a mother and a brother who was actually her nephew, but her parents had adopted him.
She had another brother, did she?
Yes. Who lived out of state. He lived in New York.
And he was a lawyer.
Yes, that's right.
And he was Wood's father.
Yes, that's right.
What was Lou Tate's mother like? What did she look like?
I can't tell you exactly. She looked like someone who had been kept in the background practically all of her life. She was what we would call today a mousy little person who didn't enter into the conversations unless she was spoken to, and neither did the grandmother. So they were usually, as soon as we had eaten and the bridge game started, those two usually left the room and went off. Wood very often stayed and played around. In fact, we were having our evening meal at the Third Street house, and Wood was sort of playing with his blocks, and I was playing with him. And he said, "I don't see why you don't have a baby. So I would have somebody to play with." And that was the night that Sam and I were going to tell them all at the proper moment that I was pregnant.
Well, what was Mr. Bowden like?
Oh, he was sort of domineering. I liked him, but I didn't like to play bridge with him, because he would get so aggravated because I didn't remember that somebody held such and such a card. I think that was another reason why I hated bridge and would play it only when I had to hold a hand. But because he and Sam and Lou Tate and I were the only ones that were there to play bridge at that certain time.
He took it so seriously.
Oh, very seriously. That was his bread and butter, was to think about bridge.
Was he retired by then?
No, but he retired shortly after we knew him.
And his occupation was?
He was a conductor on the L&N Railroad. Rode in the caboose and got to force them up for bridge every time they could get together. I mean, that was one reason why he liked bridge so well. He often had to stay in Bowling Green, so some of his old cronies were still there because they had moved to Louisville from Bowling Green.
What was Lou Tate's relationship like with her family?
Oh, she loved her mother and her father both very much. She get impatient at times with Wood or with her father, but I don't recall her ever getting impatient with her mother or grandmother. She treated them more like they were china dolls.
So you saw the big loom and you knew that she was weaving.
Mm-hmm.
What are your first memories of the cabins and how that came about?
Oh, her mother, Lou Tate's mother, gave her the cabin for a birthday present. And then Lou Tate decided to live in the big one in Esta, the one that we called the little loom house, and used the other two she had really planned to use them for teaching after she had gotten her little loom in production. The little loom came about because Mrs. Lou Tate said that she loved weaving so much while she was teaching for Mrs. Hoover. And Mrs. Hoover said, why don't you look around and get a little loom that we can use and we'll let the children learn weaving at the school. No little loom that was suitable could be found. Either their hands were not strong enough to pull the levers down, or their legs were not long enough to reach the treadles, or the shuttles were too big for little hands to hold. And so Mrs. Hoover said one day, "Well, go out and invent it." And so that's what Lou Tate did. She invented the little looms, or the Lou Tate looms.
When she met you and your husband, had Mrs. Hoover mentioned it to her yet to do the little looms?
Yes. She was working on the little looms in Louisville at the time that Sam and I moved to Louisville. In the 1936 was when we came to Louisville. And she and Dr. Mather were already working with us. And Dr. Mather said to Sam, said, "Well, you're working for Gamble Brothers, a woodworking concern. You have all kinds of tools." "I don't have any tools except saws and hammers and my tools that I, dentist tools, and so why don't you take over and you have blue tape? So that's how Sam really became involved in the making of the loom and the loom stand and the shuttle. He and Lou Tate together devised the little shuttle that is now called the Kendrick shuttle, because it was small enough for the children to hold it in their hands.
Do you remember meeting the Mathers?
Briefly, at various times. I was too busy with my housework and my work at Gamble Brothers, because I worked at Gamble Brothers too. I went to work at Gamble Brothers in 37 and worked until my second child was 6 years old before I, 8 years old actually, and then I retired. Then I went back to Gamble Brothers to work when Sally was 8.
Had Lou Tate also had the idea to have Sam Kendrick, your husband, help her with the little loom, or was it Dr. Mather who said, why don't you help her?
Lou Tate had the idea long before Dr. Mather said that, but what Dr. Mather was looking for was an out, and that was his out. Sam do it.
There was also a young man named McKnight. Did you ever meet him?
I guess I did. I must have at some time or other, but I don't really remember him at all.
When Lou Tate first went up to the cabins, did her family ever use them as a summer place?
No. No, they were strictly loom houses. And Lou Tate called it the Little Loom House because it was a house of the little loom.
So she dubbed that name herself.
Yes, she called it the Little Loom House. We called the cabin that was at the top of the hill Top House. And because of the wisteria vines that were climbing all over the middle house, we called that one Wisteria Cabin, or she called it that.
What did you think the first time you saw the cabin?
Oh, I thought, this is marvelous. Just marvelous. In fact, a Berea student was living in Top House at the time that the cabins were bought. And his name was Schaus. I forget his first name, but I had known him briefly at Berea, and it just seemed like a perfect place for somebody to live.
Lou Tate used to live at the Third Street House and mm-hmm. drive in
uh-huh.
and work and teach.
Right. But she eventually just moved everything out to the cabin on the hill. And she lived in Esta, or the Little Loom House, until her death.
Tell me about the beginning of making the Kendrick shuttle and working on the loom stand, the loom seats, the benches.
Mm-hmm. I don't know anything much to tell you except that Sam needed help, and so he got it from Vince Noltermeyer and Chuck White and Roy Heimerdinger. And Roy Heimerdinger was the one that stuck with it, because Vincent eventually left Gamble Brothers, and Chuck White left Gamble Brothers, and Roy also left Gamble Brothers, but he didn't leave the loom house and Lou Tate. So as Sam got too busy, too involved in other things, Roy gradually took over the making of the loom stands and the benches.
Where would he build them?
He built them in his basement over on, I don't remember the name of the lane.
Where would your husband build them?
Well, Sam worked in our basement. We had a screened-in porch, or glassed-in porch, actually, when we lived on Wampum Street. And Sam amassed his machinery there. And then when we moved to Woodmore, he brought his machinery with him. And so he did a lot of the work on Wampum Street before we moved out here.
Tell a little bit about the design of them and how they figured it out. Was there a billy club for the front part?
No. When Dr. Mather and Lou Tate were working on the loom, they worked with little square pieces that were inch square. And so the looms were actually constructed of these little, I don't quite know what to call them. But when Sam and Lute worked, he and Roy suggested that they be made with dowels instead of the square pieces. And so the looms were, the ones that they experimented with were made with dowels and solid pieces of wood. The hard maple or rock maple, if you want to call it that, seemed to fit best into what they wanted. So the looms and the shuttles and the loom stands and the benches were all made of this hard maple because it would stand the work with the children. By using the dowels for the rollers, and for the front and back of the loom, and then the solid pieces for the sides of the loom, it made them more sturdy. The first loom stands were made with a narrow piece in the center for the strings that went from the heddles to the treadles. But eventually, they... that made the side pieces too difficult for children to handle. They were too heavy for little children to handle. So eventually they decided on three pieces of the same size for the top of the table. And they were made on a form so that no matter which piece you took off would fit either right or left on any loom stand that you had. You didn't have to be so careful to see to it that you kept the same top together at all times.
Before long, she was selling them.
Yes, because everybody that saw them wanted them in their weaving classes. So she sold them to schools and to weaving shops, and they went overseas. She had a lot of her loom stands and looms went overseas. And the thing that amazes me is how much you get for charge for a loom today, and those were $25 and $35 a piece. If they devised a method by which you could use convert the two harness looms to four harness if you wanted to. And that, too, was a big step up in the loom.
And then the Kendrick shuttle.
The Kendrick shuttle was worked on and worked on by midnight oil with both Lute and Sam. If I had been a jealous person, he spent so much time at the loom house working on these designs that I could have been very jealous. But I was not jealous of Lute. She was my good friend. And had no designs on my husband at all.
Do you think that he must have taken pleasure?
Oh, yes. It was his baby. But that was just great as far as he was concerned. Yeah, he enjoyed it, making the designs and drawing the patterns and getting them just exactly like he wanted them. Okay. The benches that go with the loom stand will fit under the loom stand so that they take up no floor space whatever. They were made just that long, just that wide, if you want to call it wide. And they have the bench slants, I don't know how much, maybe half inch or less, or 3/4 inch, because you don't sit flat. You sit so that your body is sloping when your feet go out to go on the treadle. So the benches are made that sloping on purpose. The looms and loom stands were shipped not only to the United States and Canada, but they were shipped to England, to Belgium, to Germany, and I don't know where else. Because I had nothing to do with shipping. Lou takes care of that herself. She had an old car. It was a Willys car, and we called it Willie, and the holes in the road as you go up Blue Caper Drive real fast, and she'd say Willie would jump all the holes if she drove fast enough. And she had a dog named Wudgie, and Wudgie loved ice cream. So at the end of the day, when we would be winding up with our teaching chores, while we'd all get in Willie, hop over the chug holes, go down to the ice cream place at the foot of the hill, and Wudgie wanted his ice cream as well as anybody else having ice cream.
This is the end of five. Your two girls weaved, were taught weaving by Lou Tate, weren't they?
Yes. When they had to go with me to the loom house, when I went to help Lou Tate, and so they were introduced to the loom house almost as soon as they were opened their eyes and were able aware of what was going on around. In fact, Martha was about 6 months old when we took her to an open house at the loom house, and the brother of Ann Kuiper, John Waitman, looked at Martha and said, "Poor little thing, she can't even do anything yet. All she can do is smile. She's so pretty." We thought that was just great.
What year did you move to Kenwood Hill?
We must have moved in July the 9th, 1954, I believe is correct. I know it was July 9th because that was my mother's and one of my brothers-in-law's birthdays. But I think it was 54. We've been here. It will be 32 years in July.
So the girls, well, we have pictures of the girls all throughout the book.
Oh, yes. Sam helped take the pictures. He was an amateur photographer, and so Lou Tate took advantage of him as well as of the girls to get many of her pictures.
Tell about the early days of weaving lessons and what it was like up there.
Oh, Lou Tate was actually a glorified babysitter. Everybody, she let the children weave on Saturdays. So everybody sent all the children over on Saturdays with a quarter in their hands. And Lou Tate taught them to weave. I often helped her. And that's how my girls were so involved in weaving. As soon as Martha was six or thereabouts, she helped teach people how to weave on Saturdays. And, of course, Sally, not to be outdone, I had to help. Sally was six when we moved out here on the hill, and that made it much easier for us to get to the loom house than when we lived on Wathrop Street.
Of course, you didn't start weaving that early, did you?
No. I couldn't take time out to weave. Lou Tate always had some letters to type or some mailings to be gotten out, or needed her mailing list gone over. She had some sort of typing for me to do every time I wanted to learn how to weave. So my girls both knew how to weave before I did. I would help with the children even when I didn't know how to weave, because I knew what it was all about from having seen it. And I could cut threads and put the bobbin in a shuttle without knowing what I was up to. When the children would come and work on the two-harness loom, which was simply throwing a shuttle from one side, then changing the shed and throwing it back to the other side, and then changing shed and throwing it back again, there was a way to hold on to the... Oh, I don't know what to call it. to the way to change the sheds by moving a little rod at the top of the loom. And so Lute didn't have enough looms for every child to weave. And so one of them, when their little feet would not touch were not long enough to touch the treadle, why, somebody would change sheds for them back and forth at the top of the loom. And so one child would weave while the other changed sheds, and then they would swap. And that child then would get to weave while the other child changed the sheds at the top of the loop. They would weave so many pieces, and they would want to take them home at the end of the day, but we put pins pinned a piece of paper on saying to whom the piece belonged, who had woven it. Then we would take them off the loom when it got real fat, and I would bring them home and sift them on the sewing machine. Then we would cut them apart and give them to the children the next meeting that they had, that was the next Saturday. I had so many colors of thread, and Lou Tate and my husband both would give me colored threads at Christmas time, so that my butter bowl, my father's bowl in which he made butter, would be full of colored threads. I was raised on a dairy farm, and so my father had this bowl, which was, the first one was made out of cedar, but the butter paddle also made out of cedar that he had carved out himself. But the one that I have now with my threads in it was not the first one that father had. I don't know which one the children inherited that one, but I didn't get it. I got a commercial bowl, one that was purchased. I think it's made with out of ash. Anyway, it's white, and I just love my little bowl.
And so Lute would give you threads, but then she would come over here sometimes.
Oh, sure. She always came over and wanted to use my colored threads. So Sam, one Christmas, bought 24 bobbins to fit my machine, so that I had 24 different colors of thread on bobbins. And I had at least that much different colors in the threads too, so that I could stick any color the children wove.
Did Lute charge for her lessons to the young people?
Usually that quarter that they brought with them when they came on Saturday, and that's the reason I call her a glorified babysitter, because that was what she did.
And she would provide refreshments, wouldn't she?
Yes, they had punch and. Different ones. I was made cookies and brought them over, so the children always had punch and cookies.
What kind of relaxation did Lute take part in?
She would read omnivorously, you might say, because she read anything and everything she could get her hands on. And then she played bridge. But that's just about the only recreation that I know she had. She taught not only at different places in Kentucky, but she taught in Indiana, and she taught in Tennessee, and she would get in Willie and take off with the looms and loom stands and spinning wheels in the back of the car. We went to Fort Knox, and I'd put on a demonstration one time. And then one of the men who was high up as far as Army was concerned, I don't know whether he was a major or a colonel or what he was now, his picture's probably in some of the books, and so we can find out who he actually was. He talked to Lou Tate about doing some occupational therapy with the men at Fort Knox who had been injured. So what we did at the loom house was we put blindfolds on. We tied either our right hand or our left hand behind us. We would use either only the right foot or the left foot. So we pretended to be blind or disabled and would work out these patterns that could be used by someone who had only one hand or one foot or was blind. And then they were taught at Fort Knox to these soldiers who had been injured in battle. I thought it was a great idea. And I loved going to Fort Knox, but I didn't help with the teaching. Someone else did the teaching. But I helped with working out some of the patterns that could be used with only one hand or one foot.
She also had, in addition to her teaching, an extensive collection of drafts and coverlets.
Oh, yes, that started back in West Virginia when she would visit in the homes of the children in her school. And then people would come to Louisville, see what she had, and say, oh, my great-grandmother or my mother had such and such a pattern. Nobody uses it anymore. Would you like to have it? Tate always said yes. And so people would give her or send her loads of patterns. At one time, I'm sure she had as many as 2,000 or more different patterns. Now, some there are, take the double bow knot, which is often called an olive leaf, and sometimes has other names. And there are many variations of that one pattern. And so when people would give her something, it would sometimes be a variation of something she already had. But she never turned anything down. Anybody gave her, she took it. And she had some of the most ratty-looking old pieces of coverlet that had been out in the rain, and the whole pattern wasn't there anymore. And so when I was taking a class in how to read draft reading, we worked out some of those and filled in the pattern, wove it, and in order to see whether that was what that piece would have looked like if it had all been there. And they came out fine.
Tell the story about the M's and the O's.
Well, M's and O's goes back into my family to some of my ancestors. The two sisters who lived, my great, I'm not sure, my great-grandmother and great-great-aunt, or whether they were both aunts, lived near the Falls of the Benson at Frankfort, Kentucky. And they raised the cotton in their garden, carded it, spun it, and made the bedspread. It came down through the family, and Mother finally got it, and she said it was too worn to actually use. So she put it in the Historical Society at Frankfort. Then Lou Tate said she would love to have a piece of that. Mother took her scissors, went down to the Historical Society, asked the girl to unlock the cabinet and let her have the bedspread, and she reached inside, unfolded a piece of it, and cut a great big chunk out of it. I have a piece of the piece that Mother took off.
And then you gave it to Lou Tate.
Yes, that piece that Mother cut off was for Lou Tate. It wasn't for me, but Lou Tate gave me a piece of it anyhow.
And then she was able to look at the pattern.
Right, and make up several variations of M's and O's. And that's how she got her pattern for that.
There were also hot print patterns that Lou Tate made.
Yes, she had what was called an experimental group. I finally became a member of that experimental group after I went back and was learning to weave. But in the beginning, the experimental group wanted to make things that could actually be used. And it took so long to make a set of hot plate mats, placemats, that they devised a way to make what they call the hot plate mat. You had two that were the same size for your vegetables and one that was the same width but longer for your meat platter to sit on. And Lute sold many, many sets of those hot plate mats. They took coverlet patterns and cut them down to size or made them larger if the pattern needed to be made larger so that they fit the size of the hot plate mat. And then these patterns were Xeroxed. No, that was back in the old days when we ran the Ditto machine and the mimeograph machine before the Dittos. So the mimeograph machine was used to make many sets of these, which were mailed all over the world to different people that wanted the patterns to the hot plate mat.
You also talked about Fool's Puzzle.
Oh, one day a lady showed up at the Loom House with what she called the Drunkard's Path or the Fool's Puzzle. That's two of the names for it. It has other names as well. And it's black on white. Somebody yelled, "Op art!" And everybody wanted to make that. So Lutek let different ones get busy on it. I was not in on this. And they made a pattern that would fit the hot plate mat. And then somebody enlarged it and made a ball hanging, and somebody else made a pillow top. And so there, you will find many variations of the Fool's Puzzle at the Loom House.
What about the end of carving?
Oh, we had a little rabbit that used to come on Saturday, and the children just loved him. So Lou Tate made a little story up about the little rabbit and how he... what he would do, and so we wanted to do Harvey. She drew many pictures of Harvey till she got just what she wanted Harvey to look like, and the one with his little tail, his little scut showing, and just his ears where he's sitting down with his back to you is called the end of Harvey. I love to make the end of Harvey much better than either as side views of Harvey, because they're easier to make. So the end of Harvey is the end of a story that Luke wrote.
You also took lessons. I mean, you finally were able to learn how to weave.
Yes.
How did you talk Luke into letting you learn how to weave?
I talked her into it by simply telling her that I was going to learn to weave. I was tired of doing all of her typing. And then we weren't doing so much typing in the days that I learned to weave as we had been when the Loom House was first started on Kenwood Hill. This was many years after that had started.
Did you take lessons from her directly?
Yes. Yes. All the hard work that went into it, like sitting up at night and counting threads under a magnifying glass until your eyes would nearly go out. And drawing it all down onto draft paper. I did all of that.
Because you said you had homework.
Yes, that was it, was to count the threads. She would give us a piece of material, and we would count the threads and actually allow one piece of on the, what kind of paper is called? Not this, graph paper, yes. Allow one opening on the graph paper to be for each thread. And so you would end up with a fairly large piece of four pieces of graph paper put together, sometimes as many as six or eight put together to get your whole pattern on. And we color them with colored threads. I colored the pencils are with colored ink.
What kind of a teacher was she?
She sort of held on to a lot of her secrets. She wanted to, she would tell you she wanted you to work it out yourself. And so you would. And then you sometimes came up with something slightly different from what she had come up with when she did the same thing. And that gave her an extra pattern or an extra edge or an extra idea for something. She was quite generous in giving you what had already been worked out. But she would never tell you her secrets about how she arrived, which was a pity, because today we could use so much of that knowledge that died with her if we had it.
Was she patient?
Very patient, yes. with the little children especially. She sometimes got impatient with me because she'd known me too long. And she was always, I would ask her to tell me something because she had been my friend for so long. Oh, Susie, she would say, go ahead, you can do it. And leave me on my own, especially when we were doing patterns that she made the reverse treadling. She often left me stew about my reverse treadling.
You were on the founding board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also, in the very month after Lute's death, instrumental in opening the Loom House back up again.
Yes, it seemed such a shame for it to die, and because I had known her too long. I had known her for 52 years. We were going to have a fight, knock-down, drag-out fight, when we had known each other for 50 years. When that year came, Sam had died, and I was in Hawaii, and Lou Tate was in the hospital with pneumonia, and she didn't know at that time that she had the cancer. But we didn't get to have our fight, which was okay. But she always said I was the one person that wasn't afraid of her. And I didn't do too much presuming on our friendship, our long friendship. And some people seem to presume on their friendship, but I didn't.
Before she died, didn't she start teaching kindergartners?
Yes, she thought that kindergartners, as well as the six-year-olds, 6 and 8-year-olds, should know something about weaving. So she devised this loom, a rigid loom, with the little, they were supposed to have pegs on the side. They ended up with having screw eyes on each side. And then the piece of material was laid down, and the children learned that you went over and under and over and under until you formed what would be cloth. It was very interesting to them. And they thought they had done such a great thing to be able to have several red pieces and be able to take a blue piece and weave it in and out and have a checkerboard sort of pattern when they got through. And they had done something.
We did not mention earlier that Ann Kuiper's mother, whose maiden name used to be Wakeman?
Uh-huh, Wakeman.
Had gone to school, had her mother, Mabel, had gone to Berea.
When she, her mother was Mabel Palmore at the time she had gone to Berea. And she was Lute's roommate at Berea. So when Mabel had learned some weaving at Berea and also taken some lessons under Lute, they had remained friends over all the years. And so when Mabel was getting ready to marry Bob Wakeman, why, she wanted to weave her own wedding dress. So she came to Louisville, and Lute helped her set up one of the big looms, and she wove her wedding dress. And she not only was married in it, but Anne was married in that same dress.
And we have a picture of it.
Mm-hmm. And Anne was, who doesn't have any children of her own, but has a number of children that, foster children, expect that someday one
will have to go.
That dress.
I do want you to tell a little bit about being on the founding board of directors.
Thank you, Tika, for letting me talk. I have always been glad that I was one of the first board of directors of the foundation. And, I don't know. Just good to know you that are writing this history. Because I love Lute very much, I'm so glad that I've been a part of it. 1979?
July.
Is that in July?
Yeah, I'm a little late.
Mm-hmm.